Welcome to the Money Maze podcast. I'm Simon Brewer, and Will Campion and I have created this show to explore and unravel some of the mysteries surrounding the investment business. We hope through direct and insightful interviews with masters of the real-life money maze, we're going to learn about different approaches to allocating capital, making investment and business decisions, and navigating the pitfalls that line the paths to prosperity. Whether you're a current or aspiring investor, entrepreneur, professional, or a student exploring career options, we hope you gain some helpful insights and enjoy the shows. You can keep up to date by visiting moneymazepodcast.com, and please sign up to our newsletter to ensure you won't miss a release. If you enjoy the show, please subscribe, and we'd love you to tell a friend or colleague about it. Thank you for listening. We're delighted to have Schroders as a sponsor and corporate partner. Schroders is a global investment and wealth manager with a purpose to provide excellent investment performance to clients through active investment management. By serving institutions and individuals worldwide, Schroders serves wider society. Channeling capital into sustainable and durable businesses accelerates positive change in the world. Funding the future is a privilege. Schroders use it wisely and responsibly. As we know, capital is at risk with investing. A word on our other sponsor, Bremont, an award-winning British company that produces beautifully engineered chronometers, designed to appeal to those who share the passion and appreciation of the innovation and mastery behind a beautiful mechanical wristwatch, brought to you by our title partner, the luxury British watchmaker, Bremont. When we talk of luxury watches, we think Switzerland. Quality engineering, specialization, dominant market position, apparently illustrating the economist David Ricardo's theory of comparative advantage. But it wasn't always that way. By the turn of the last century, Britain was producing 200,000 watches a year, around half the worldwide output, and Rolex was founded in London in 1905. When your father is killed in a plane accident that almost takes your brother's life as well, it proves to be the inspiration to build a luxury watch brand which can compete with the best. So to tell the story of building Bremont, I'm delighted to welcome the co-founder and CEO of Bremont Watches, Giles English. From the new headquarters in Henley, Oxfordshire, Giles, welcome to the Money Maze podcast.
Thank you for having me on, Simon. It's a real pleasure, and I've obviously listened to your silky voice for many podcasts, so it's an honour to be alongside some of your esteemed guests. Obviously, I'm not esteemed, but it's nice to be on here anyway.
Thank you for these kind words. Well, let's begin with your childhood. Maybe you can give us a flavour, because I think you had an unusually brilliant father.
I did. He was this amazing individual, PhD aeronautical engineer from Cambridge, who was with the RAF. Although he was an intellect, he had this amazing passion for being in the workshop and talent at it. So our life as young kids was in this workshop. It was never really going outside playing football with him. It was sort of fixing, building things, and anything from cars to aircraft to boats. He built a sailing boat we went and lived on as kids for 6 months, to obviously watches and clocks. So that was really our whole livelihood growing up, was tinkling around on little bits of metal and wood.
You yourself decide to study engineering with naval architecture, which is definitely a first on this show. That's quite specific. Why?
Obviously, my father built this sailing boat, and we had this passion for sailing as children and growing up. And I always loved seeing him with this drawing board, drawing pictures of beautiful sailing boats. And I used to build model yachts, and I thought, oh, this is brilliant. This is what I want to do. Go and draw beautiful sailing boats and eventually race them and build them. So I went to Southampton, which is this number one place almost in the world for doing naval architecture. And then I realized I did 4 years of doing stress calculations and off bulkheads of supertankers, didn't draw a single sailing boat. Yeah, very, very technical. And I enjoyed it and I got something out of it. But yeah, I didn't draw a single sailing boat throughout my time there.
And so therefore, were you already thinking of a different profession?
Well, it's interesting. When you're in the world of engineering and to that level, your career's advice is very much, well, you go into a technical team and as interviewed by aerospace companies. And I thought, actually, I don't want to be a hardcore engineer. I've got very much an engineering brain, but carrying on those stress calculations just didn't really excite me. And obviously, as with all engineers at universities, you get the city coming in looking to get those mathematical brains to join. And that's when I went into corporate finance post Southampton for a small little company called Williams de Broe, which I thoroughly enjoyed, but quickly realized I wasn't going to be any good in the city. I was far too much of a, had a sort of entrepreneurial feeling, but I learned so much there, being there for about 3 years, just understanding, reading accounts. We were doing IPO listings. So I learned a lot, but I quickly realized that it wasn't the life for me.
So I want to turn to the tragic events of 1995. Your father was killed, your brother almost killed when their World War II vintage Harvard plane crashed. And I think you were ready on the ground to take off in the plane behind. Just tell us a little bit about that day.
Yeah, you come across life, these sort of tipping points, these life-changing moments. And for us, it was the most beautiful day, March, sunny day like it is today. And as a family, so dad, myself, my brother went up to do a day of formation flying in these World War II aircraft. And we'd done a lot of flying. I was sponsored through university by the RAF. So that was very much a big passion of ours. And on that beautiful day, it all went horribly wrong. And I was on the ground and I heard over the radio this crash had happened. I was praying it wasn't dad and Nick, and it was. And dad died immediately. Nick shouldn't have survived. He broke over 30 bones. He was sort of thrown out into the middle of this field. But luckily, HEMS air ambulance were very close by. They got to him. They got him to Whitechapel Hospital. And there he sat lay in intensive care for many months, but had this amazing recovery. But that whole day just changed my life and Nick's life considerably. And having to call up your mother to tell her that her father's died and her son is in hospital is possibly the worst thing you can ever do. And that triggered this, it's better to go and live life and you've got to make the most of it, sort of atmosphere that we created between us. And we just went down this route of following this passion. And we'd grown up around watches. Our father had this sort of massive desire to fix these clocks and watches. And we were so aware growing up as well, this amazing history of British watchmaking that you mentioned in your introduction. And 100 years ago, we were making half the world's watches. And at the time that Nick and I had this sort of crazy idea, there wasn't a single British watch company you could buy off the shelf. And that really triggered this desire to actually, look, let's go and do something completely different. And we went off to Switzerland, told our wives it would be 2 or 3 years we would do it, and please back us. 5 years later, we hadn't sold a single watch and we didn't realize quite how hard it was going to be. So, yeah, but it all really came from dad's plane crash.
Well, I want to rewind, excuse the pun, just to frame what happened in the world of watchmaking. When I visited your facility, you mentioned this Yorkshireman, John Harrison, but just set the stage.
It's just such a fascinating story. So back in about 1703, over 2,000 sailors were lost coming back from a Spanish armada off the Scilly Isles. And they were lost because they couldn't measure where they are. They couldn't navigate longitude. And you can do latitude with a sextant, but longitude, if you don't know the accurate time, it's impossible. You could be massively out. And the government at the time and the king, they introduced the Longitude Act. And ultimately, it was a reward for £3 to £5 million of today's money for anyone who could go and work out a method to actually measure time at sea or measure longitude. And there were lots of different theories of how you could do that. And it's a ridiculously complicated task because not only did you have to map the stars so accurately, but you had to create a timepiece that would work at sea. And everyone thought that was actually impossible. And John Harrison, a carpenter from Grimsby, came down to London and he really just reinvented the way a clock would work. Because the only accurate timepiece at the time were pendulum clocks. If you put a pendulum clock on a ship, it goes massively out of time with the movement or temperature changes. And he dedicated his life. And by about 1760, he had created this marine chronometer. Everyone thought he'd gone slightly mad. It wasn't going to work. This was not his first attempt. He'd been at it for many years. And he gave this clock to various captains. One was Captain Cook, who discovered the world. And really, it transformed Britain. We're a seafaring nation. Suddenly, we could navigate those seas more accurately. We could turn up to wars with less ships because they could all get there. You know, dissemination of information, trade, the whole lot. And those early chronometers were 30% of the value of the whole ship. So they were incredibly precious items. And that really spearheaded this period of British watch and clock making that put us in the center point in the world, and hence, obviously, Greenwich Mean Time. But you had Arnold, Mudge, Graham, Tompion, all these great British watchmakers, and that was the boom time. Got to 1900s, and then we had Boer War, First World War, Second World War. Britain was slow to industrialize, but also, and you've seen in our factory, we can machine to about 5 microns of accuracy. If you can machine to that level, you can build guns, planes, anything. So as soon as the war effort came on, German watch industry and the British watch industry were supporting their own war efforts. Swiss is a neutral country. They carried on making watches and they weren't disturbed there. So Smiths was the last big British watch company that died out in the 60s. So there's some wonderful history to sort of put into perspective, and all these great inventions that came from British watchmakers. And it was such a sad to see that go. But Nick and I wanted to do a little bit of resurrecting that. And to resurrect that was not just making a watch in Switzerland, being a British watch company being made in Switzerland. It was bringing it back to the UK. But you've got the technical issues of how you physically build those watches, but also the branding, the getting over this Swiss-made area. But yeah, sorry, a long-winded way of giving you a bit of a history of British watchmaking there, Simon.
Well, it is. I think it is fascinating. But of course, everything's in the name, and Bremont is a very nice name. But how did that appear?
Yeah, not very English, is it? So when we started, Nick and I didn't want to go and buy an old British name. I could have gone and bought the name Harrison. If you look at all those, something like 750 Swiss watch companies, so many of those are resurrected brands. They weren't trading 50 years ago. They're resurrected. We didn't want to do that because how as a company could we work with the military, Martin Baker, Jaguar, all these different amazing partnerships we have, but if we were still pretending we were marine chronometer manufacturers from 1760. So we wanted to create our own brand. Obviously, my surname's English. It wasn't going to work very well on trademarking and on a dial of a watch. And this slightly random incident, about 3 years after Dad died and we were tinkering with our watches, we didn't have a name on the watch at that point. And Nick and I were on a flying trip, one of our many flying trips. And these are days before GPS. And we were flying over France and we got in some terrible weather and we just couldn't find the airfield. It's low mist and we're running out of fuel and we had to force land in a French farmer's pea field. And if you do that in the UK or the US, you just give the farmer a bottle of whiskey and say sorry and take off when the weather's better. But in France, they impound your aircraft. They make you take the wings off. They ship it to an airfield. It's a disastrously expensive thing to be caught out on. So there we were in this French farmer's pea field, and this lovely old boy came over and said, no, put it in my hay barn, wait till the weather gets better. And we ended up staying with him for a couple of days. And he's this wonderful character in his late 70s. Yeah, he would have been our dad. My dad died when he was 48, or 49. And had he lived to this age, he would have been just like this old boy, playing around with clocks and old motorbikes and tractors. And we left a couple of days later, and his name was Antoine Bremont. We thought, Bremont, actually, that's quite a nice sounding name. So we called him up and said, look, we're not going to associate you at all with this. We just let the name. Are you happy with it? And he went, crazy Englishman. And that was it. So that's where the name Bremont came from.
So there are two components, as I see it, to your business. You're building a watchmaking capability and you're building a luxury brand. How do you and your brother, who you need to just qualify exactly what he does with you in the company, but how do you think about those two components?
Well, first, my brother does a really good job of sweeping floors and cleaning the windows. Actually, he's the talented one. So I probably work a bit more on the marketing now. Nick does a bit more on the product. But really, we overlap in so many different areas. We've got a brilliant team now within the business who are doing most of the hard work. The challenge, as you said, is we wake up every morning. We are one of the most accurate machinists of metal in the country because we make watches. You have to be. Working machines that are almost £1 million, these are very complicated CNC machines, to training up watchmakers in a country that hasn't made watches. Yes, they've been servicing watches, but haven't been making new watches for so many years. So putting apprenticeship schemes for training up watch assemblers and watchmakers. So really our day job is, how can you make this beautifully made mechanical watch? We only do cogs and gears that will be chronometer rated and will work, not come back, not break, and be beautiful and appealing to the general public out there. But on the other hand, you can make the best product in the world, but if no one knows about you, you're never going to actually get out there. And you're having to build a global brand because that businessman wants to see you in Hong Kong and New York and London. And our competition are spending hundreds and hundreds of millions on marketing. So that's always the challenge. You have to be a very good marketeer and a very good engineering business. And obviously we own our own retail stores as well, so you have to be a good retailer. So it's deeply complicating, and you're up against some incredibly good competition. And our competition are generally the groups. They're owned by the Richemont, LVMHs, the Kerings, the big groups. But we saw it as saying, look, it's a big market out there. All we need is a slight percentage of that market to actually build a very successful business. And what is lovely is we're not in tech in terms of what luxury watches will go out of fashion in the next 2 years' time. You have to grow very quickly. It's about building that long-term luxury brand in a sustainable way in the UK. So it does keep you awake, though.
I think you said seeing is believing in the context of watches. And I mentioned in the podcast the other day, having been to your new facility and just as a non-engineer, just how stunned I was by its excellence. But what is it when people visit your facility that you think happens to them?
Yes, Simon, it's a very good point. When you touch, we go into a retailer and buy that watch, you put it on your wrist. You like the look of it. It's the right size. It fits you. You buy it, so you take it home. But really you have no conception of how complicated and all the effort and investments gone into building that watch and the skills created accordingly. So when you come to Henley, it's so nice to now be able to show you this is how the parts are machined. Those cogs and gears all ticking away together. This is how finite, this is how complicated they are to produce and put together, and really showing that in a day, there's 86,400 seconds in a day. A mechanical watch that we sell will be within 3 or 4 seconds accurate. And if you think that's the most accurate mechanical object out there as a chronometer rated mechanical watch, it's genius engineering. And this is being worn on your wrist 24/7, needs servicing every 4 or 5 years, but that watch will last 200 years. There's no reason why that watch can't be serviced and repaired and will work in 20 years' time. And I love that. And when you come to Henley, suddenly you can see the light bulb moment go off in people's heads and go, yeah, I totally understand why it costs that much money. And yeah, so it's lovely to finally have a facility where we're happy showing people around.
So it's the fusion of engineering and branding. And I, as an unashamed James Bond fan, I know that Ian Fleming wrote many years ago, A Gentleman's Choice of Timepiece says as much about him as does his Savile Row suit. Well, there may be fewer Savile Row suits post-COVID, but are there going to be fewer watches as many young people are thinking about being able to answer the phone off their wrist?
We've seen out of nowhere, Apple has become the largest watch brand in the world, and it's an amazing feat. But where I think that's really affected is the fashion watch market. People have gone for the iWatch, but it still doesn't give you that statement piece. However much you pay for Apple Watch, you're going to chuck it away at 2 years' time and get a new one. It has no long-term value associated with that. A lot of individuals will wear both, and they'll have their smartwatch for their exercise and other areas. but actually long-term value. It's about the only piece of jewellery a man wears. And it's a lovely thing to collect. Over the years, you should make money on it or lose very little. So it's still got a lot going for it. But I think getting the young into it is very important. I think the fact they're used to wearing something on their wrist, if it is a smartwatch, that actually helps. It's getting people wearing it. But no one really quite knows where the market will go over the next 10 years. Really, in our space, I can't even compete with that. I can't think about it too much. I just have to do my best at growing the brand and taking market share from everyone else. So if the whole market is not growing, that doesn't really bother me as long as more people are buying my watches. And we're ambitious. To invest in the UK, we need to grow ourselves as a business. Otherwise, we can't put that extra engineering investment in. So we need to grow as a business and we need to grow around the world.
So when we look at your collections, you have worked with the collections around Concord, Jaguar, Stephen Hawking, Bletchley Park. And I think in many cases, there are components of those topics in the watch. Tell me a little bit about how that came about and how you think about the next collection.
Yes. So every year, the watches you're referring to are big limited edition pieces. And it all happened about 12 years ago. We came up with a watch. A friend of my father's owns a very famous Spitfire that is totally original. And he's replacing part of the panel on the wing. And he held this metal and he said, "Do you realize this is being flown over Germany and by a 19-year-old boy on this day in 1940?" And we looked at it and it's very emotional. We saw the clock in the Spitfire and it was off an old Smith's clock. And this sort of light bulb moment went off and said, "Look, why can't we actually do a watch? We'll call it EP120 off the Spitfire and we'll put that metal into the watch and create something which is really unique, only making 120 watches. And we did, and they sold immediately. And we realized actually these historical limited editions, we'll do one a year and we create something which is quite unique. And yeah, the most recent one was the Stephen Hawking Foundation. And we can raise a lot of money for charity in the process, but we're creating something which is mechanically stunning. Each movement is very different in those watches, but has that historical reference. And that's got meteorite wood from Stephen Hawking's desk, paper from one of his seminal theses within it. But you are creating this sort of total work of art. And they've become big PR pieces for us as well. And now there's lots of spin-offs of other companies copying us now and what we're trying to do with that. But I think the trick is never to be gimmicky, raise a chunk for charity in the process. And that's very important for us to do. But when you come through our facility and you see all the different bits, working with Wright Flower, it's got fabric from the first wing of the first plane that ever flew. We did enough to restore Wilbur and Orville's family home in Dayton, Ohio, for the back of it. And as you said, Bletchley Park, HMS Victory, these amazing watches. And we'll have collectors who'll buy every single one of them and built a lot of friends through them.
And in parallel with that, the types of machines you have doing this very fine work, whilst they predominantly exist in Switzerland, are they made in Switzerland? Is it a pretty closed market?
We've had to work with the Swiss for many years and build some very close relationships. It is quite a closed market, but we wouldn't be here now without the Swiss. They've helped us considerably. The machines, probably half of machines, we're the only watch company ever to have bought one outside Switzerland. The other machines, we work with DMG Mori, which is a German-Japanese business, and they make a lot for the aerospace, motorsports industry. You see them a lot in Formula One engineering. But we've had to convert these to work for us, and we've had to train new skill sets on it. Because when you're machining to those micron levels, there's just nothing else that needs to be that accurate apart from watchmaking. So literally, we're getting engineers who've been in the industry working in aerospace or motorsports, and we're retraining them. And then the finishing on these, what else is produced in metal that people get a loop out and look through the loop and it has to be utterly perfect? There's just nothing else that really happens like that. So it's incredibly challenging, but really rewarding when you get it right. And yes, the Swiss have been supportive to us. And I think they want it's in their interest to make mechanical watch industry to get through certain barriers. The quality has to be there, and they're very protective over that, as they should be. But on the other hand, we are waving this British flag of actually saying, look, the Swiss are very good marketeers. I know the Swiss are dominant in the watch industry now, but they were not always dominant. And we are playing our little part in that revival of British watchmaking.
So we had Gary Boom as the CEO of Bordeaux Index on a few weeks back to talk about the world of wine. And he was very clear about the continued and enormous wealth generation, particularly, as we know, in Asia. Can you talk a little bit about where your growth is coming from?
Oh, yeah. It was fascinating hearing him on the Bordeaux Index, and what a business. If we look at the market at the moment, it's not been the easiest 12 months. Where the luxury watch space is very much about touching, feeling that product. The luxury industry wants to deliver the top service. And can you really do that online? And I think if you're a business turning over probably 30% of your sales online, you've benefited from lockdown. You've had online really set up going well, and suddenly all that volume has gone through your high margin online. That's not been the space for luxury watches. We've also seen, especially with the lack of global travel, China has just grown considerably. China is now 50% of global watch sales is going on within China. And that's just such a massive level. So if you are a luxury group with a high exposure to China, actually it's really worked very well for you. We as a business aren't. We'll hopefully open our first store in Shanghai this year, but I think you ignore Chinese at your peril, and I think that's continuing to grow strongly. I think there's a lot of money out there in the whole sector. We've seen discretionary spend has people have got sitting on a lot of cash, and historically, watches and jewelry, one of their big competitors has been luxury travel, and as people have stopped doing that. Also, other sectors, if we look at probably our business, we're turning over a reasonable figure with the cruise industry. That stopped. So as a business, you've had to sort of change and run around. But I think the long-term growth over the next few years through luxury watchmaking, I think it will bounce back. I think it'll be very positive. I think the average sales price is going up. It's becoming less of a volume game. The premium purchasing of some of these high-end watches, it's almost easier to sell a very expensive watch than a cheaper watch. I think the market will head on that way. There isn't really an opportunity for a lot of consolidation in the watch market. Most of the watch brands you name are also currently owned by a group, and they are becoming more and more powerful. If you look at Rolex and Patek, they are a massive percentage of the luxury watch sales. And I think in times of uncertainty, there is a flight to the biggest brands. It is that certainty that consumers want. So they will continue to grow strongly, but it's still a big market out there. So us as a business, we will grow our individual retail, whether that's working with our wholesale accounts or directs. And I see that being a trend, increasing that level of customer exposure. And I think online is now here to stay in the luxury watch industry. That will probably have gone to 5% and may go up to almost 20%. And I don't see why that will go away. So there's been some material changes and shifts, and retail locations will change at the moment. So if we look at London at the moment, we're still probably 60% down footfall, even now lockdown has ended within the centre of London. Obviously, airport retail was a massive part of luxury watch sales. That's gone. You've had tax reductions, so you don't have the VAT is now being charged in the UK. That will have some changes in the UK luxury sector as well. So some change going on, but positive, I think, going forward.
I've been to your beautiful shop in Audley Street in Mayfair, and you are opening, I think, later this year in Manchester. Where else are you globally?
Well, the key markets for us in the US, we have our own store in Madison in New York and just about to open in LA, but we've got wholesale across the US. UK is a very strong market for us. The Asia, we've store in Hong Kong and Australia. So they are sort of key markets. And then China launching in Shanghai and growing out there. So Asia, I think, will go from being probably 5% of our business, and that will grow considerably over the next 2 or 3 years if we can get that right. It's difficult. You've got to change your messaging when you go into a new market. The whole brand, the made in England works in England, but does that work in China when they just want Swiss made when it comes to watches? So it's a challenging area. And also 20% of our business is just making for the military around the world. And that's predominantly UK and the US. That message is not going to resonate well in China when you're positioning US jet pilots. So you have to really be very careful about how you're branding and pushing that forward.
So I think you referred at some point in time, you were given sort of their three rules about starting up a business, and they're all around how tough it is. Tell me about that, and how tough has it been?
We developed quite early into our business, and my advice for any entrepreneur doing anything is this three times rule. And that is undoubtedly true. It always takes three times longer. It always costs three times more, and it's three times more effort. And if you're not willing to really go for that three times rule on day one, then give up now, because it never goes directly to plan. But that hard work really shines through. And I think we've done something that no one else has really done in the luxury watch industry, especially for the last 20 years. And that's incredibly exciting. And yes, we can pat ourselves on the back, but we feel we're only just starting really in what we can do and what we should be doing. But it's back then you have to sort of readdress that three times rule and say, look, have I really got that energy and investment to sort of go on to that next level? And I think with any business, any entrepreneur, people can give up far too easily or underinvest. And it does take investment. What we're trying to do, if we'd made so much more money if we'd just outsourced the manufacturing. All other watch brands our size out there just don't do any of it themselves. They just outsource it all. And they just do the frontline branding. But that wouldn't have been any fun. That wouldn't have built up British watchmaking. And enthusiasm you get from clients walking in and seeing that big machine wearing away, machining metal, is just too much fun for Nick and myself. So it's a long-term journey we're on. But I think, yeah, if we can continue that three times rule, we'll get there.
But you were a corporate financier for a while. When we talk about patient capital, this is a long-term payback industry. How have you gone about identifying and partnering with long-term investors?
That's a really good point. If we got our standard VCs in who want that sort of 3 to 4 year turnaround, that would have been very difficult. The benefit for us, though, is that every year we're building our brand, we're creating more value in the business, and our business will be here in 30 years' time. It's not a tech play that will be gone or that the high risk. So you won't get that ridiculous high growth, but you will have that longevity in who we are. And we're very lucky to get some investors earlier on who really backed that long-term play of what we were able to achieve. And I think if you are happy to take that long play, they will get the return. There's no doubt about that, but you have to really give it that time. And we've shown that, and we've created something that I think everyone in the team are very proud of. And eventually, yes, for them, they need to see an exit. So how that exit comes, is it a selling their individual shares or a total sale? Who knows? But really, I think from Nick and myself perspective, you can't aim for that. Even if the business ever did get sold, Nick and I would still be very much involved with the business. This is our baby. This is something we love. But you have to ultimately, when you get investors on, you have to give them a return. So quite how that pays out. Are there benefits for listing a business like ours? Possibly. But I think listing, you need a real reason to go and list. Is it to make acquisitions? Is it a brand growth piece? Because it's not really an exit. Do we want to be bought by a Swiss company that one of the big groups that will want to close down UK manufacturing because it doesn't fit in with their centralized model? Well, that won't work for us. So who knows where we'll end up?
I mean, what do you wish you'd known 15 years ago when you were starting out?
The three times rule, I think, would have been a good one. No, I think we have achieved what we wanted to achieve. But I think along the line, when you're building a business, you make big mistakes. And those mistakes may be around timings for investment. They may be around product growth, going to new markets without being prepared enough or with that investment behind it. I think we've learned huge amounts along the way. And that whole thing, my advice of anyone going into a new market, you've got to properly do your due diligence beforehand. And that costs money. Just because you've got one client who wants to take your product on is not good enough. So put that proper investment into it. But would we have changed anything different into Nick and I with this mad idea and starting out and going to watches? No. Could we have made quicker money by doing other things, jumping on other trends? Probably yes. But the satisfaction we've got together, and it's amazing. When you have last week, Harrison Ford decided, he called us up and through a friend of a friend and said, look, I love watches, I love aircraft. Is it possible to come for a tour around your facility? And how many other businesses do you get that? And Nick Mason flew in last week and had a tour around. And these are people who are generally passionate about watches. And our customers are such lovely people. It's a wonderful space to be in.
And not everybody sets up and runs a business and holds a business together with a member of their family. Any advice on running a business with a brother or sister?
Yeah, I think make sure you get on with them very well beforehand. The lovely thing about working with family is, one, we do product design together. We've grown up with the same taste. We like the same things. That makes it easy. But I think with running any business, any partnership, it's all about trust. Can you trust the partner you're working with? And I've always known that Nick would never screw me and I would never screw him. And ultimately, if it's a business partner who's not family, he will put his own interests above yours. And that's just fact. And when all is going well, you don't argue. When it's not going well, that's when the cracks appear. And that's the beautiful thing about working with Nick. And I think had I done it with anyone else along the way, it wouldn't have worked. And I'm lucky that he's very talented at what he does and helps to deliver what we have delivered without that. And it's been fun. The only downside is Nick is my best mate who I only see work-wise now. So very little on the fun side together. Which is the downside.
So I've got three non-watch questions. What's the most important daily habit you have?
Actually, in slight sadness ways, but I've become slightly obsessed with gardening. And going out into the garden at some time out at this sort of hectic world we live in, just to really sit back and take in nature and get away from everything. Get away from your phone because your head is down in the flower bed. Not much, but I try and go out every day and do something.
And if you could fly anywhere in the world, where would you fly?
Right now, out of the UK. Just get out of there and do it. I think, where would I like to go? A little island off Thailand, I think, probably at the moment, with my family for that getaway. But either that or into space. I quite like the idea of sitting next to Bezos and all Branson going up in space, experiencing that. But I think we all just want to get on a plane and get out of here, don't we?
That's probably very, very true. So my final question, you may have answered it with your comments about Harrison Ford, but who other than Harrison Ford would you most want to wear one of your watches?
Who other than? I think we're very honoured to have presented Prince Philip a pocket watch, the Jubilee that we custom built for him. But I think a lady's watch on the Queen, I'm a huge royalist. I think what they've done is so positive for the country. And having that royal warrant on the Queen's wrist would be, without doubt, our proudest moment.
Fantastic. Well, maybe we can send a copy of it and hang it in Magdalen College and they'll be enlightened.
Yes,
anyway, Giles, thank you so much. As I've said, and I think anybody who would and could come and see your facility in Henley should do so, and we'll make sure the links are available on the show to be able to contact you, because it really is absolutely inspiring to see a manufacturing facility which is just state-of-the-art and the collections alongside it which are so timeless. So congratulations on what has been an extraordinary journey. And our thanks again to you and your brother for being an early sponsor of the Money Maze podcast, which has been really appreciated. We've really enjoyed our association so far.
Well, really appreciate that. And we'd love to show anyone around. And Simon, thank you. I'm honoured to have been on your show. Clearly, there are people a lot more interesting than myself, but it's been an interesting journey. It's lovely to tell the story.
Thank you for listening to the Money Maze podcast. For more information or to subscribe, please visit themoneymazepodcast.com. Hope to see you next time. All content on the Money Maze podcast is for your general information and use only, and is not intended to address your particular requirements. In particular, the content does not constitute any form of advice, recommendation, representation, endorsement, or arrangement, and is not intended to be relied upon by users in making any specific investment or other decisions. Guests and presenters may have positions in any of the investments discussed.